It was early in the morning, July 4th, 1952. Fog was hanging thick in the air when Florence Chadwick waded into the cold water off Catalina Island, and she was going to make the long swim to the California coast. Long-distance swimming was not new to Florence Chadwick. She had already become the first woman to swim the English Channel in both directions. The water that morning was numbing cold, and she would swim for some 15 hours. Her coach would constantly encourage her because she couldn't see more than a foot in front of her, and all she could see was the fog, and the support boats that were along with her would constantly tell her which direction. Sometimes she'd have to be directed again so that she would be heading for the shore. On several occasions, the sharks had to be driven away by rifle fire. After swimming for 15 hours, Florence Chadwick asked to be taken from the water. She had given up. Later, she was interviewed and she said, It wasn't that it was cold or I was exhausted or I was afraid of the sharks. It was that I couldn't see my goal. It was clouded by the fog. And would you believe she asked to get out of the water just 30 minutes short of the coast? I am convinced that the reason more and more Christians are asking to be taken from the water is not because of exhaustion. They are asked to be taken from the waters of Christian discipline and duty, not because of fear, but because there is a fog that has settled in, and they have lost sight of God's clear goals for their lives. I think in our age especially, that's true, because blessings that we have around us have turned into a curse. Howard Hendricks said repeatedly in our classroom in seminary, he said, "We in the Christian world are like a poor photograph. We are overexposed to the light and underdeveloped." Why is that? We are surrounded by pamphlets and sermons and conferences and tapes and books, and all of those are good and fine, but underneath that inundation, we have lost sight of the goal. What is it? Do you know? Do you know? We need to clear the fog and go back to God's basic goal. We are going through the Gospel by John, as you know, and we find ourselves in John chapter 12, which will serve as a wonderful divine fog remover, beginning with verses 22 and following. And it gives us the clear picture, perfectly clear, that God has a couple of goals in mind at this stage. Goal number one, the goal that the Father has for His Son, is that His Son die on the cross. Goal number two for the believer is that we as Christians die to self. Now, you may remember in our discussion that we left off with the Greeks coming to Jesus for this in-depth interview. They were wondering if this Messiah would include the Gentile world or if he was going to be for Jews only. Jesus responds by saying, let's pick up our story at verse 23, "The hour has come," Jesus said. Now, that's a change, by the way, from what we've been studying for these some 20-plus sessions. In John chapter 2, verse 4, Jesus had said, "Mine hour has not yet come." In John chapter 8, verse 30, it says that they sought to lay hands on Jesus, but they couldn't because His hour had not yet come. In chapter 7, verse 20, again, they sought to lay hold on Jesus, but they could not, for His hour had not yet come. Now, chapter 12, verse 23, Jesus says, "Mine hour has come." For what? Well, Christ tells us, "For the Son of Man to be glorified." Now, you would expect Christ to say here, "The hour has come for the Son of Man," a messianic title, "to be crucified." He says, "The time has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." You see, Jesus Christ is looking past the crucifixion to the coming glory of being obedient to the will of the triune God. Look over to verse 27 with me. Let's read that paragraph. "Now my soul," Jesus says, "has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify thy name." There came therefore a voice out of heaven, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. The multitude therefore who stood by and heard that voice were saying that it had thundered. Others were saying, an angel has spoken to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice has not come for my sake, but for your sakes. Now judgment is upon this world. Now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. That is Satan's chief weapon in his arsenal. Death is about to be destroyed or defeated, I should say, forever. Verse 32, and I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw him into myself. John explains, but he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. In other words, Jesus is saying, you lift me up from the earth on a cross, a Roman cross, and you will not silence me. In fact, you will create the opportunity for this beacon of light on this Calvary Hill to shine out a personal, worldwide invitation to the glory of God. That's what you're about to do. So it's about time for me to be glorified here and in the future. That's my goal. Now, Jesus, in three brief sentences, in three very brief verses of Scripture, will give us three clear principles that are God's goals for our life. And what I want to do is sort of clear the fog away so that we can see clearly these principles. Let me give you the principle and then we'll look at the verse. Principle number one, if you want to have a flourishing life, you have to be willing to die. Look at verse 24. Truly, truly, I say to you, Jesus says, this is the truth here. Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains by itself alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. The truth here then is that God's children are like God's seeds, the gardener God. Left alone, we are like a little seed, insignificant and small. But within it, within us, is this life principle. And if we will be willing to be buried, that life principle can erupt and it can flourish and bear fruit. You say, but God, I don't think I want to volunteer for seed duty. You know why it's hard to volunteer to be a seed in the hand of God? I thought about this, a couple of reasons came to my mind. First of all, I think it's difficult to say, here am I, Lord, bury me, because first of all, if you volunteer to be a seed in the hand of God, you are giving him the right to determine what kind of seed you are and what kind of fruit you will bear. Now, down the street from where I live, there's a family that attends the church here, and they have recently planted a garden. I don't know anything about gardening, but I know that that is a perfect garden. The rows are straight. Everything is immaculate. I pulled over to talk to him one day and found out he's a soils expert with the university here at NC State. That's how come I'll never have a garden that looks like that. But anyhow, he has this perfect garden. And I stopped and talked to Steve, and he sort of pointed out the different things in the garden. And I asked him why this row of corn was taller than these other two rows, and he said, well, it's two different kinds of corn. One's a robust yellow corn, and the other one's a sweet corn, and that's a little smaller. I said, oh. So he's sort of explaining it, and he told me that over here he had the squash. That was a waste of soil. But anyhow, there was the squash over there. And over here in the other corner were the tomatoes, and already they'd come up. And, you know, tomatoes, they sort of bow and bend, and he already had a stick or two propping them up. Well, I left after telling him what a magnificent job he was doing, at least from a novice's eye, it seemed to me. And I came back, and this whole week I've been studying seeds and burial. Not necessarily death, but germination, although Jesus says we live a death-like life when we are buried, that is, we die. And I thought about this, and I wondered as I went back into my mind to that garden, can you imagine if seeds could talk? Imagine going to Steve's garden, and I slip over there, and I hear that underneath the dark soil, just after being buried, these seeds are carrying on a conversation. And over in that corner over here, the tomato seeds are carrying on. In fact, one tomato seed has the floor. And so I listen in. And that tomato seed is complaining to all the other seeds. And the gist of his conversation is, I don't want to be a tomato plant when I grow up. That's about it. He says, I want to be one of those corn stalks. They bear more. They grow taller. They don't have to be propped up by sticks. They grow closer to the sunlight and the warmth, and everybody notices corn. Lord, I don't say that, do I? Oh. Lord, I'm your seed to be buried, but I want to tell you what kind of fruit I want to bear. I want to tell you what I want you to turn me into. I want to tell you what kind of life I want to live. Whether I want to be propped up or whether or not I'm going to grow tall and strong, let me tell you, you see. So I want to have more seeds volunteering for duty, because if we do, we give him the right to determine what kind of fruit we will bear and what kind of plant we will become. Now, I think there's another reason. Not just that, but there's another reason it's difficult to volunteer. It's because you're giving God the right to plant you, to bury you, wherever he wants to bury you. For some, it's a quiet occupation with quiet serving gifts that are never noticed. For others, it's vocal, it's upfront, it's leadership, it's administration. For others, it's hidden. For some, obvious. And you want to bury me where exactly, Lord? Where did you say? I've got my little seed life. I have built a little nest, a little house for the seeds and the little seedlings. I have a little car to carry the little seedlings around in, and we've got our merry little life, and you want to discomfort me? You want to disturb that and bury me somewhere for you? I don't know. And by the way, Lord, I'm not saying this with my lips, but there is a message from my heart that basically says, this seed is not for burial. And keep your hands off my seedlings. I want them growing up in the same plot nearby so that we can enjoy our barren, fruitless lives together. How tragic. Some of you are hiding from God the gardener. Perhaps if a seed could complain, it might of the cold, dark earth where it's left alone. But see, that is God's design for that seed to be there, to be buried, to, as it were, die so that it can flourish with fruit. On January 12th, 1722, Jonathan Edwards, who's preaching, by the way, impacted America. He would, by his ministry, God would use him to bring about the first of America's great awakenings. As a 19-year-old student, he wrote in his diary these words, I have been before God, and I have given myself all that I am and have to God, so that I am not in any respect my own. Neither have I any right to this body or any of its members. No right to this tongue, these hands, these feet. No right to these senses, these eyes, these ears, this smell or this taste. I have given myself clear away and have not retained anything as my own. Jonathan Edwards was saying, God, here I am, bury me, even though I might want to be something else or do something else or be somewhere else. Here am I, Lord, bury me. Bury me. Principle number one, Jesus says, if you want a flourishing life, you have to be willing to die. Principle number two, if you want a fulfilled life, you have to be willing to forfeit control. That's even tougher. Look at verse 25. And you need to circle, if you would, in your text, the key word, which is life, as I read it. He who loves his life loses it. And he who hates his life in this world shall keep it to life eternal. Now, this verse is difficult to understand simply because the English reader is at a disadvantage. The truth is, the word life, which appears in this text three times, is actually two different original words. The first time it appears in your Bible, or the first two times, it's the word psuche, which is translated most often soul. It has to do with the functions of the soul, that is the mind, the will, and the emotions. The last time in your verse it appears, it's the word zoe, which, as it relates to the word eternal, is talking about divine life, the God-inspired life, not only now, but forever. So Jesus is saying, look back at your verse, basically this, he who loves his own mind, emotions, and will, that is his own destiny-determining plans, his own agenda, he will, Jesus says, self-destruct. He will destroy himself. Now, you may have noticed the use of very strong words in this verse. He who loves his life. He who hates his life. The words love and hate are extreme opposites, but Jesus uses the same terms here also in the book of Matthew, where he says, if you want to be my disciple and you do not hate your mother and father, you do not hate your wife and children, you do not hate your brothers and sisters, yea, even your own life also, you cannot be my disciple. Now, what in the world is Jesus saying? What does he mean? Well, first of all, he's using the language of exaggerated contrast. So that it really means this. He's using hate as it refers to loving less, far less. And he uses the word love in reference to priority. You love it so that you put it first or in first place. So with what we just learned, we could amplify this verse this way. Let me read it. You kind of follow along as I add words to amplify this translation. He who gives first place to his mind, emotions, and will, his own plans, will destroy himself. But whoever gives first place to me will ultimately experience life worth living forever. Makes more sense, doesn't it? George Mueller, a man who started orphanages in England and maintained them by a rather unusual prayer life, was once asked the secret of his ministry, and he responded with these words, "There was a day when I died. I died to George Mueller. I died to his opinions, preferences, tastes, and will. I died to the world, its approval or its censure. I died to the approval or blame of my friends. And since then I have studied to show myself approved unto God." What did Mueller do, ladies and gentlemen? George Mueller forfeited control and ultimately lived a fulfilled life. You say, I want that kind of life. Do we? Lord, I will abandon control of my plans and my destiny and my will to yours. But first, would you show me how it balances in the checkbook? First, would you give me some guarantee that your plans are going to make me happier than mine? Because otherwise, I'm going to keep control. The interesting thing is that Jesus Christ doesn't give those kind of statements. In fact, it's interesting that Jesus never adopted popular recruiting technique. Today, the popular recruiting technique, which may not be all that bad, but basically it says if you sign or join or enlist, think of everything that you will see. Think of everything that you will do. Think of everything that you will have. So sign, join, enlist. Jesus comes along and says, if you enlist with me to serve me, you're not going to do what you want to do. You're going to do what I want you to do. But in doing what I want you to do, you'll discover really the fulfilled, flourishing life. And in doing what I want you to do, you will be liberated from our selfish culture and our self-centered nature, which demands that we do what we want to do, when we want to do it, and where we want to do it. Period. Think of what Jesus could have said. Follow me, and you're going to see some things you've never seen before. Follow me and you'll walk on water. Follow me and you will be leaders in an emerging organization known worldwide. Follow me and I'll give you that. He never did that at all, did he? He said, you want to follow me? Good. How many want to? Well, I want to. Good. Are you ready to die? Are you ready to forfeit control? He's asking for everything, isn't he? J. Oswald Sanders, whose writings you ought to read, has written a book on discipleship. And he told the illustration or the story of the early 1800s when a village organist in Germany was practicing in the cathedral for the coming Lord's Day. And he was practicing, for those of you who play the piano, you know, one of the difficult works of Mendelssohn. He was struggling away and didn't notice as he played in that massive cathedral that a stranger had slipped in and sat in the dimness of the back pew listening. After the organist finished his practicing, he got his papers together and he shuffled his way out and he was stopped by this stranger who said, would you mind if I played? And the village organist said, absolutely not. Nobody touches that organ but me. The stranger persisted and persisted and persisted until finally, reluctantly, the organist said, "All right," for just a moment or two, and the stranger slipped onto the bench. He took that piece of music that man had been struggling with, and he played. And the music echoed throughout the whole cathedral. After he finished, the village organist said, "What is your name?" And he said, "My name is Felix Mendelssohn." Ladies and gentlemen, we have to allow our master, creator, musician to slip onto the bench, to pull out the stops he wants to pull out, to select the console he will play on, to push the pedals he wants to determine the piece of music and the speed and the volume and what music he will make. He is the only one who can make music out of your life, but you have to get off the bench and let him play. See, that's what it means to be buried, to die to self. That's what it means to hate your own life. It means abdicating the bench and saying, "Lord, you play. You play." Principle number three, if you want to be honored as royalty, you have to be willing to live like a slave. It's harder, doesn't it? This is Jesus' recruitment plan here, by the way. If I could add three summary words to either your notes or maybe the text in the margin of your Bibles, it would be these. Verse 24, the summary word for that verse is expendability. "Lord, I am here. You use me up if you want. I'm expendable for you." Verse 25 would give us the one word, priority. That is, your will is priority. Your kingdom is priority. Your designs are priority over mine. In fact, yours compared to mine, mine are despised and hated, and yours are loved and cherished. Verse 26 would provide the word ownership. And the key words in verse 26 are right in the middle. You ought to circle them. My servant. Let's read the whole verse. "If anyone serves me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall my servant be also." If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Did you notice what a servant does? He serves his master, first part of verse 26. He follows his master. It's a matter of ownership. Who's following who? There is a subtle shift taking place. I read it in Christian magazines. I read it in Christian articles. I see it in books, and I love books. You ought to see my library. But there is a subtle shift taking place in the thought of American Christianity. The average person praying 50 years ago who'd written books that I read, the average prayer would have been, "Lord, use me." Today, it's, "Lord, enrich me." A generation ago, it would be, "Lord, consume me by thy will." Today, it's, "Lord, satisfy me according to my will." It's subtle. But we live in the age in which it is predominant. And you need to be thinking critically along that line. The reason I believe we have it turned around is that we've come to the point in our lives where we believe that wherever we decide to go, God is going to faithfully tag along. Whatever we decide to do, God is going to just, well, goodness, stamp it with His approval. Oh, no. Wherever He goes, we faithfully tag along. Whatever He decides to do by His Spirit through His Word, we stamp it with our approval. At a conference in South Carolina, a young woman was giving testimony to her commitment to serve Jesus Christ, and she stood up. In the course of her testimony, she held a blank sheet of paper up for everybody to see. The only writing on it was down in the lower left-hand corner. It was her signature. And she, in her testimony, basically said, "I have given my life to God, and I have decided to do His will, even though I don't know what it is. This blank piece of paper is my life. I'm allowing Him at His will to fill in the blanks. But I've already signed my name." She had become a slave to the ownership of God's will. And the truth is, she's going to be honored eternally for it. Now, after hearing Jesus' recruitment plan, I'm glad to be able to tell you that he knows we're human, we are frail beings of clay. And so before he ends those three brief sentences, the Lord Jesus graciously throws in two very brief incentives. We've already read them, but we've overlooked them. So let's go back. Incentive number one is the promise of a special communion. Look at verse 26 again. If anyone serves me, let him follow me. And guess what? Where I am, there shall my servant also be. Did you catch that? Special communion. We've got two kids. Our twins graduated from second grade with flying colors, I might add. And we have a kindergartner who graduated from there as well. So they're home all day long. This is an exciting time for moms all across America. So I thought I'd help out this very first week of summer, and I gave my kids this incentive. I said, look, if you guys will behave and not run your mother ragged all week, come Saturday, I'll take the three of you to the golfing range. No, they were excited. Take my word for it. No. You guys are cynical. Let me explain. We love our family, the putt-putt version of golf. It's my speed. We enjoy it. We are so competitive, though. We get out there and we play. We did it about a month ago, and we're having a great time, but we're also keeping score. And every two or three holes, we're adding it up to see who's winning. I want you to know, last month, I won both games. Of course, I kept the score, but I just want to share that with you. Well, anyway, these kids wanted to learn how to play real golf, you know, hit it off the tee. So I said, all right, what we're going to do, if you behave, get along, we're going to go. So they were impeccable for the most part of the week. And so come Saturday was our time to go, and we went and had a blast. I got them out there and had little three cubicles, and we lined them all up. Now, I would tell you, what did it do all day? It rained. So I was thinking, you know, what are we going to do now? I asked the kids. It was fine with them. They didn't want to miss this. They'd been looking forward to this time. Daddy's going to take them there, and so we're going to do it. So we get in the car. We're driving along, and it's raining. And the closer we get to the Duffer's Range, it's called, which is an appropriate title, by the way, it's raining harder. And so we pull into the parking lot, and we're sitting there, and all these guys are scurrying with their bags to their cars, and we're coming. And I said, guys, what do you think? Oh, Daddy, let's go. Let's do it. Let's get out there. Okay? So we got out of the van and made a mad dash for the little modular unit there where the office is, and we rushed in there, and I said, we're here. My kids were standing over there by the door, and he said, you're going to do what? I said, well, we're here to get a bucket of balls. We're going to go out and hit a little bit. And he says, no, I'm closing up. It's raining. Well, we knew that, but I said, my kids are going to be devastated. They're right here. See them? They were sort of wet. We've got to play. I promised them all weeks. So he says, okay, you get a little bucket and go ahead. So we got that, and I lined the kids up, and we had a ball. And I taught them, as if I know how to hit the ball off the tee. And they hit it just like I did. Once they connected, it kind of starts out straight, and then it kind of takes a sharp left and lands near the ladies' tee over there somewhere. Well, at any rate, you golfers will appreciate that. We had a blast. It was brief. It was wet, but it was something my kids weren't about to miss out on. Now, you want special communion with your father? Look back at the condition in verse 26 again. You say, I want to grow close to God. Great, read this book. Go to this seminar or this conference, and I'm not against those. Oh, no, we so often overlook Jesus Christ's condition for communion. Look at it. Circle the word if. If anyone serves me, let him follow. And where I am, there shall my servant also be. Jesus says, I have a little secret for you. Special communion is for servants only. Incentive number two. If special communion for now isn't enough, there is this promise of a special coming commendation. Look at the last part of verse 26. Circle the condition again. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. That's future tense. It's a reference to the Bema seat, the judgment seat of Jesus Christ, where the saints will be rewarded. I happen to believe that there will be degrees of rewards in heaven, just as I believe the Bible teaches degrees of punishment in hell. There will be people who've placed their faith in Jesus Christ who will stand before God at the judgment seat with Jesus as the judge. And as the gospel writer said, their lives will burn up as wood, hay, and stubble. That is, their lives made absolutely no difference to the glory of God after they were saved as before they were saved. They will have empty lives. Then there will be those, and Jesus mentions it here according to this condition, who will receive precious gems, crowns of His design that we will then, after receiving, with great thrill, give them back. That's the incentive Jesus uses for prospective seeds. If anyone serves me, He says, the Father takes note. He notices. And He will honor you. Honor is the word timao, which refers to compensation. You live for Jesus Christ in that corporate world, you probably have said to yourselves, I don't see what in the world it's getting me. You live for Jesus Christ, then it will be compensated eternally. It has to do with esteem or reward. The best way I can think of illustrating this is the graduation line. All of them and everybody else, whether graduating from high school or college or graduate school, everyone walking in that graduation line is absolutely thrilled to be there. They finished. But there are some people in that line that have little embossed gold stickers, either on their gowns or on their diplomas. It has to do with this word tamao. It's the word honor. Cum laude. Honor. Magna cum laude. High honors. Summa cum laude. Highest honors. We will, standing before Jesus Christ, every one of us be thrilled to be standing on the border of heaven. We are there. But in that line, there will be people with high honors. There will be people with highest honors. That's the incentive. Expendability, priority, ownership. These three words have a way of clearing away the fog of God's goal. Expendability. God, I am expendable. I understand by your word that I've been given spiritual gifts, at least one, to be used in your body, the local assembly. Frankly, God, I haven't done a thing but sit. I'm willing to serve. I want that special communion. I want that honor. Priority. God, I believe that you've given me resources, not only of time and talent, but money. I've been financing my kingdom only. I will begin to finance yours. Priority. Ownership. God, I will no longer try to make you my slave. I will become your slave. And Jesus says, if you will do these things, if one day my Father will honor you, He will reward you. And for all of eternity, ladies and gentlemen, you and I will be forever grateful for the day, the moment when we said as His children, Lord, here am I. Bury me. Bury me. Bury me. Lord Jesus, we understand that you are asking for everything from those who claim to know you, who gave everything. You've asked us to be your servant, to be your seed. Lord, it is difficult, I will admit, for all of us here to abandon ourselves, even though we know it's a sovereign hand, because we want to control the kind of fruit we produce. We want to control the kind of person we're becoming. We want to control the surroundings wherein we grow. Forgive us for that. Remind us that our liberty and our joy and our flourishing experience comes only as we are willing to die to self.